This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, Zionist bullies and local officials team up in an attempt to censor an event on the Israel boycott movement at Brooklyn College in New York. We'll speak with reporter Alex Kane of Mondo Weiss in New York City to talk about the attacks by anti-Palestinian leaders and their boycott smear campaign, and what this means in the context of growing support for the Palestine Solidarity Movement.
This was just the latest battle in a sort of a raging war, I guess you could call it, over free speech, academic freedom, and student organizing for Palestinian rights.
Also, zero justice, not one charge in more than 100 cases against Israeli soldiers for attacking Palestinians in 2012. Israeli forces arrest lawmakers in raids on cities under the so-called control of the Palestinian Authority. Palestinians in the Jerusalem area to be evicted as Israel plans to build new garbage dumps on their villages. And news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, including how Israel is stepping up its SodaStream marketing in an attempt to greenwash settlement crimes. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. We begin in New York City. An event organized by the Brooklyn College chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine, featuring a discussion by Omar Barghouti, an activist, author, and founding member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, and Dr. Judith Butler, a philosopher, professor, author, and a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, was held on Thursday night, but not before weeks of aggressive bullying by not just members of the Israel lobby, Zionist organizations, and the anti-Palestinian fanatics, but by members of the New York legislature in a concerted effort to shut the event down. A group of politicians, which included members from the Progressive Caucus in the New York City Council, demanded last week that, quote, Brooklyn College's political science department withdraw their endorsement of this event. As our next guest, Alex Kane, pointed out, quote, the department, in fact, did not endorse the event. They explicitly and repeatedly said that they had agreed to co-sponsor it and did not endorse. Going further, New York City Councilman Louis Fidler wrote a letter that threatened to cut funding to the college if the event was allowed to proceed. Brooklyn College's president, Karen Gould, stood firm in her defense of the event as a matter of academic freedom and the right for students to have fair and open debates on campus, especially a political event hosted by the Political Science Department. The New York Times also published an editorial on the issue in Wednesday's edition of the paper. The editors stated that they, quote, strongly defend the decision by the college's president, Karen Gould, to proceed with the event, despite withering criticism by opponents and threats by at least 10 city council members to cut financing for the college. Such intimidation chills debate and makes a mockery of the ideals of academic freedom, end quote. New York City's mayor, Michael Bloomberg, held a press conference on midday Wednesday and stated that although he is a staunch supporter of Israel, quote, I could also not agree more strongly with an academic department's right to sponsor a forum on any topic that they choose. I mean, if you want to go to a university where the government decides what kind of subjects are fit for discussion, I suggest you apply to a school in North Korea. The last thing that we need is for members of our city council or state legislature to be micromanaging the kinds of programs that our public universities run and base funding decisions on the political views of professors. I can't think of anything that would be more destructive to a university and its students, unquote. By Wednesday afternoon, it had appeared that the signers of the original letter by so-called progressive politicians had backpedaled. Corey Robin, a political science professor at Brooklyn College and a major proponent of the event and the college's rights to support free speech in the face of intimidation and threats by legislative officials, posted on his blog on Wednesday that, quote, now that the mayor, the New York Times, and just about everyone else have come down hard on all the government officials and politicians who tried to force my department to withdraw its co-sponsorship of the BDS panel, the, quote, progressive politicians have issued a second letter to Brooklyn College President Karen Gould, in which they backpedal, pull back from their earlier position. No longer, it seems, must we, quote, balance this panel or withdraw our co-sponsorship. Corey Robin added, quote, that it took a billionaire mayor to explain these simple matters to our progressive leaders is, well, what can one say? This entire episode has been an instructive example in courage and cowardice, shame and shamelessness. Much congratulations go to the mayor, to President Gould, to the students who organized this panel, and above all to my colleagues in political science, who stood absolutely firm on principle throughout an extraordinarily difficult time. Finally, as the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima tweeted on Thursday, quote, "Zionists know they can't win debates, so they try to prevent them. Now they can't even prevent them." The event was held without disruption on Thursday night at Brooklyn College. Joining us to talk about the battle over Brooklyn College is our friend Alex Kane. Alex is the assistant editor for Mondo Weiss and the world editor for Alternet, and has been doing steady reporting on this issue since the beginning. He joins us from New York City. Alex, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, let's talk about the actual event that happened on Thursday night with Omar Barghouti of PACB and Dr. Judith Butler, a philosopher and educator and longtime advocate of human rights and civil rights. Set the scene for us inside and outside the event and talk about what the speakers said and how they were received by the audience.
Well, the event really went off without any problems. I arrived on the early side around like 5:30, and there was already a pretty heavy police presence there. You know, they were expecting some counter protesters across the street, and there were there was barricades set up, and there was a pretty long line even that early. You know, the event didn't start until 6:30 or 7, and there were people lining up. So obviously, all the controversy really caused a lot of people to pay attention and to want to come out to see what Omar Barghouti and Judith Butler had to say. Before the event actually happened, I checked out the small counter protest that was called by pro-Israel groups. It seemed like there were students from Hillel there. There was also Assemblyman Dove Hicken, who I spoke to briefly about his opposition to the event. But they were very small in number. There was only about 30 to 40 of them there. The event, you know, once the event started, it was really powerful and striking. I think there were the majority of people there were already supporters of Palestinian rights and the boycott movement, but there were certainly some students there that were just going to sort of learn about it, and I think they got a really great distillation of what the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is all about. And it was, all you had to do is listen to Omar Barghouti and Judith Butler talk about why it's important to be involved with this movement. And, it was a powerful refutation of this charge that, these are anti-Semitic hate mongers. I mean, they both gave very calm, reasoned presentations, emphasizing that BDS is rooted in international law. Judith Butler did a fantastic job in refuting the anti-Semitism charge, as did Omar Barghouti. It was great. And the question and answer session was also interesting. There were a few questions that were critical of Barghouti and Butler, but in general, the questioners were also friendly to Barghouti and Butler. And Barghouti got a lot of applause when he was speaking. And in general, it was just a fantastic event and a real big victory for free speech, academic freedom, and for the movement for Palestinian freedom.
Alex, let's talk about the lead up to the event and what Alan Dershowitz had to do with it and how a group of so-called progressive politicians joined hands with the anti-Palestinian, anti-BDS crowd, including Dov Hilkind, who is a member of the Jewish Defense League, a group that has been deemed an actual terrorist organization as well as a violent extremist group by the FBI.
Yeah, that's right. So it appears that it was Alan Dershowitz that first, he made the first sort of, he fired the first shot in the campaign. He wrote a New York Daily News op-ed, and the Daily News themselves also had an editorial. They're owned by Mort Zuckerman, who's a real ardent right-wing Zionist. Dershowitz, most of the politicians, including Dershowitz and Hickens and the progressives, they all said that, the event should be able to go on, but that the real problem was that it was the political science department's decision to co-sponsor it, which they claimed connoted endorsement, which the political science department, said that, well, that's actually a conflation of the two terms. They're different. So, you know, Dershowitz sort of fired the first shot, and then there was sort of a torrent of calls to either shut down the event or rescind the political science department's co-sponsorship of it, and both Dershowitz and Hickens, you know, labeled the boycott movement, anti-Semitic and hateful. The thing about Dershowitz is that his hypocrisy was exposed in this because, he himself had spoken against the University of Pennsylvania BDS conference last year, and his talk was sponsored by the UPenn Political Science Department. So he really had no legs to stand on. Hickens was another one who had no legs to stand on. You know, as you said, he is an avowed former member of the Jewish Defense League, former because the group has sort of fizzled out. But, you know, he told me last night that he was proud of his time with the Jewish Defense League, although he sort of dodged my questions about how can he oppose, say, Hamas and Hezbollah, but yet, you know, be a follower of Mayor Kahane and also, a member of the Jewish Defense League, which, as you said, was linked to the violent attacks. And then as for the progressives, you know, they also, in their first letter, this was a letter organized by Representative Jerry Nadler. He's from New York City, a member of the House of Representatives. Him and three other congressional members, as well as members of the New York City Council Progressive Caucus, signed on to a letter that demanded the Political Science Department withdraw their co-sponsorship. And this was yet another example of, progressives, except on the issue of Palestine, weighing in on this issue. And it's really only because I believe that it was mostly about political gain for them and pandering to the, Israel lobby groups in the city. You know, they know that one of the Israel lobby's sort of center of powers is in New York. And they thought that it was a good idea to demand the political science department withdraw. There was a whole lot of outrage directed at these progressives, and they actually came out with a second letter 2 days ago that, well, it was pretty weaselly, and it was equivocal. They backed off their demand to the political science department to withdraw their co-sponsorship. So, you know, across the political spectrum, you have politicians pressuring the school either to cancel it, which was another letter from Councilman Lou Fiddler, maybe we can get to talk about that later, which also included threats of funding. Everyone from Dove Hickens, who's on the far right, although he's a Democrat, he's on the far right end of the spectrum, to, Councilman Brad Lander, who is a progressive on most issues. You know, he has spoken out against the New York Police Department surveillance against Muslims, but, you know, he signed his name to the letter, and that really demonstrates how our politics are so busted on this issue.
That's the voice of Alex Kane of Mondo Weiss and Alternet. And as you said, Lou Fiddler wrote that letter that threatened to cut funding to the college if this event was allowed to proceed. What does this say about the nature of not just what's happening at Brooklyn College right now, but the nature of intimidation and threats and attacks, of criminalization of dissent and criticism of Israeli policy on college campuses across the U.S. You know, you and I have both done extensive reporting on what's happening at the University of California system, for example. So talk about the larger battles at hand here and what this Brooklyn College debacle looks like in the context of the ongoing fight for free speech and student organizing for Palestine on campus.
Right. Well, this was, as you said, just the latest battle in a raging war, I guess you could call it, over free speech, academic freedom, and student organizing for Palestinian rights. You know, the Lou Fiddler letter was perhaps the clearest example of how legislators are smearing student activists as anti-Semites, as hate mongers, and threatening the well-being of their schools. And I think, you know, this is a phenomenon that is particular to public universities. You know, private universities, while they may have donor pressure, legislators have no role in how they're funded. But when it comes to public universities, like Brooklyn College, which is part of the City University of New York system, as well as the University of California, you often have these legislators who feel that, you know, because they're responsible for the funding, that they are able to sort of dictate what gets said and what doesn't get said. And that's really dangerous to academic freedom. You know, in the University of California, as you mentioned, there's been a number of efforts to also suppress criticism of Israel on campus. This is, you know, largely in response to the success of the Students for Justice in Palestine organization. And, you know, their push for divestment in California. And, you know, as there's this bill, H.R. 35, as, you know, we both reported on that, that basically smears student activists as anti-Semites, supporters of terrorism, and so on. And, you know, it's really one and the same battle. The Lou Fidler letter and the California legislators weighing in on this, they're really on the same side. And it's all about suppressing criticism of Israel on campus. And they're suppressing criticism of Israel on campus because they know that, you know, college students, you know, college campuses are where these battles are taking place and where activists are making the most inroads, you know, with the Berkeley divestment battle, although that was ultimately unsuccessful, that really brought a lot of attention to the divestment issue. You know, we have the current UC Irvine process to try to get their schools to divest from companies complicit in Israeli apartheid. And so it's one and the same battle, and it's something that it's going to continue. You know, the University of California, you know, arguably it has been going on even longer than other things, and you had a series of things like the Campus Climate Report, you know, Title VI civil rights claims filed against schools for supposedly allowing, you know, anti-Semitic environment to flourish, although, you know, those claims are largely about Palestine solidarity organizing and not about real anti-Semitism, and it's really one and the same battle.
We're going to have to leave it right there for now, but of course we will continue to follow these stories very, very closely. That was the voice of Alex Kane. He's the assistant editor and reporter with Mondo Weiss. He's also the world editor for Alternet. You can follow him on Twitter at Alex B. Kane, that's spelled with a K. And you can also read all of his reports on MondoWeiss.net. And for our reporting on this issue, of course, go to electronicintifada.net, where you can read David Letwin's op-ed, Dershowitz's attack on the boycott Israel campaign smacks of desperation, and all of Ali Abunima's writing on this issue as well. Alex Kane, thank you so much for all of your work and for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks, Mari. I appreciate it.
The Electronic Intifada reported this week that the Israeli legal advocacy group Yesh Din, quote, has found that out of 103 investigations opened in 2012 into alleged offenses committed by Israeli soldiers in the occupied territories against Palestinians and their property, not a single one has so far resulted in any charges. Ali Abunima added in his post, quote, from 2009 to 2011, Yesh Din says in its latest report, just 2.62% of investigations led to charges. The figure from 2012 represents a deterioration in the already shocking lack of justice for Palestinians living under Israeli military tyranny. From 2005 to 2011, Yesh Din found previously that 94% of criminal investigations launched by the Israeli Army's Criminal Investigation Division against soldiers suspected of criminal violent activity against Palestinians and their property were closed without any indictments. Yesh Din has also said that in the rare cases where charges are filed and convictions obtained, punishments are usually no more than a slap on the wrist. Abunima added that so far in 2013, six young Palestinians have been shot and killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Quote, while no credible investigations, let alone accountability, are expected in any of these cases, the occupation regime's sick joke of a justice system continues its harsh crackdown on its victims. Those were excerpts of a longer report published this week. For much more on this topic, go to our Rights and Accountability blog at electronicintifada.net. The Electronic Intifada reported also in our Rights and Accountability blog this week that Israeli forces have conducted sweeping overnight arrest campaigns in the West Bank at the beginning of the week, according to news sources and the human rights group Ad-Damir. And most of those targeted in the early morning raids are leaders in the Hamas movement, three of whom are elected lawmakers in the Palestinian Legislative Council. Quote, Israel currently holds as political prisoners 15 Palestinian legislators, five of whom are held without charge or trial, a practice known as administrative detention. The Palestinian news agency Maan citing an Israeli military spokesperson, reported that a total of 25 Palestinians were arrested in the overnight raids on Sunday in multiple West Bank cities and towns, including 23 persons affiliated with Hamas. Mann adds, quote, 12 other Hamas officials were seized in the raids overnight Saturday, as well as several Palestinians not holding a political position, according to local sources. The Electronic Intifada added that both the cities of Nablus and Ramallah, where some of the legislators were arrested and taken, are designated as Area A under nominal Palestinian Authority control, according to the Oslo Accords signed by the Palestine Liberation Organization and Israel in the mid-1990s. Quote, however, Israel routinely raids areas ostensibly under Palestinian autonomy and faces no resistance from the Palestinian Authority. The Gaza-based Minister of Prisoners' Affairs stated that the arrests, quote, wouldn't have been made without high-level security coordination between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, according to Ma'an. For much more on this story, visit our rights and accountability blog at electronicintifada.net. We now turn to occupied East Jerusalem, where the Israeli municipality is planning to build a massive garbage dump on top of Palestinian villages in the area. The plan is part of a wider effort to link illegal Israeli settlement colonies between those in East Jerusalem and others elsewhere in the West Bank. According to the Palestinian human rights group Adala, approximately 32,000 Palestinians live in the villages of Anata and Al-Isawiyah, which are located close to the so-called E1 area that, when completed, will cut the villages off from the rest of the West Bank. The Electronic Intifada added that as well as a new 130-acre dumping ground, quote, the waste plan includes the construction of new solid waste management buildings and roads. The plan will also bring changes to the water, sanitation, electrical, and telephone infrastructure. The site will be used to dump 5 to 8 million cubic meters of solid construction waste over the course of 20 years. Adala attorney Suhad Bishara explained in a video that Palestinian communities will be enormously affected in terms of environmental hazards and health, but also in terms of losing their lands. Quote, we know of about 150 Palestinians living in the area from the Jahalin Bedouins that will be evicted from that area, end quote. The Electronic Intifada added that Anata municipality has formally objected against the landfill plan at the Jerusalem District Planning and Building Committee assisted by Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, and the Civic Coalition for Defending the Palestinians' Rights in Jerusalem. For more on this story, visit our rights and accountability blog at electronicintifada.net. And now we go to news from the Global Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. In our Activism and BDS blog, Amina Salim takes a look at the growing marketing campaign by Israel to brand SodaStream carbonated drink-making products as an environmentally sound and healthy alternative to the usual brand of soda. Salim writes, quote, the central advertising message is that by buying a SodaStream machine and making fizzy drinks at home, people no longer need to buy pop in plastic bottles and cans. The central problem is that SodaStream operates out of an illegal Israeli settlement in the West Bank, and as such, the company is complicit in war crimes and contributes directly to the Israeli occupation. It also falls foul of a new report on Israeli settlements released by the UN Human Rights Council on January 31st. Which states, quote, private companies must assess the human rights impact of their activities and take all necessary steps, including by terminating their business interests in the settlements, to ensure that they are not adversely impacting the human rights of the Palestinian people in conformity with international law. Salim adds, quote, the SodaStream plant operates out of the industrial sector of Male Adumim, one of the largest settlements in the West Bank, built on land stolen from the Palestinian towns of Abu Dis, Azaria, Atur, Isawiya, Han al-Ahmar, Anata, and Nabi Musa. The municipal tax paid by the company goes to the Male Adumim municipality, where the funds are solely used to support the growth and development of the settlement. Quote, moreover, SodaStream brands its products as made in Israel, thus unfairly exempting them from customs fees when exporting into the European Union, The 2000 EU-Israel trade agreement exempts goods imported from Israel from customs fees, but does not exempt settlement goods. This mislabeling has been highlighted as a possible case of consumer fraud. Salim says that despite the overt complicity in Israel's occupation and illegal settlement enterprise in the West Bank, UK media and politicians are, quote, lining up to help the Israeli state in its promotion of SodaStream. Salim cites a party hosted by the British Israel lobby group BICOM for members of parliament who are also part of the Friends of Israel group. The party was held on Israel's election night a few weeks ago, which was also, quote, a promotional event for SodaStream, who provided refreshments for the guests. Quote, BICOM was thanked from the platform by Israel's ambassador to the UK, Daniel Taub, for promoting, quote, a great Israeli export. For much more on this story and other current news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, check out our activism and BDS blog on electronicintifada.net. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, be sure to check out the arts and culture features, our newest op-eds, also a child survivor of the Gaza massacre denied medical treatment by Israel. Will Samer Issawi be the next victim of medical neglect by the Israeli prison service? The Month in Pictures, a curated regular feature of the most powerful photos in and around Palestine, and much more. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.